Welcome to the Live Your Life podcast, episode number 2. Today, I'm going to be having a conversation with David Hartman. David and his wife, Diane, started the Wellness Institute, which is where I have been doing my training for the last 5 years. What better way to explain the work that I do than to have the person who taught me explain the work? So stay tuned for a great conversation about hypnotherapy, consciousness, subconscious thinking, and how to make real behavior change. I'm Jasmine Savari, and welcome to the Live Your Life podcast. As a coach with a master's degree in psychology, I know that so many of us are missing the authentic experience of truly living our lives. I want to inspire you with conversations that expand your consciousness and empower you to create the best life possible. Let's start living now, because now is all we have. Hi, David, and welcome to the Live Your Life podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So I know I did a little intro, but I'll just say that David is one of my teachers. Pretty much everything I know about the subconscious and hypnotherapy and a lot of the work that I do came from the work that he does. So what better place to get some information about this than from the source itself? So let's start by talking a little bit about hypnotherapy. So, David, I'm wondering if you can give everybody an overview on what exactly is hypnotherapy?
I laugh because I would say requesting to know exactly what it is impossible. It's partly mystery, partly being discovered, and certainly what we'd call an inexact science. Hypnotherapy is a tool that we have learned to use and actually has been known since the beginning of time, probably, or a method of accessing the deep unconscious. And we all people know that we have a deep unconscious and we have access to it in certain settings. An example is our dreams. And we all dream every night, even though some of us remember those dreams, some of us don't. But we know from research that we all dream. And the mental activity we're having during our dreams is different in very significant ways from the mental activity that we have when we're awake. And we could go into some of those differences, but basically suffice it to say, it is a direct expression of the unconscious.
Yes. Okay. So I know I'm in the right place in my life because I get so excited talking about this, even when you technically don't have an answer for me. I love it because I'm completely hooked on this work and I'll do it forever. So maybe you could say a little bit about, like, what is the subconscious compared to the conscious mind?
Yeah. Well, once again, there are differences of opinion about that. You know, Freud and just about everybody is familiar with the principle that Freud pioneered over 100 years ago, that all human beings have mental activity that is unknown to the conscious mind, our conscious awareness. And so it sometimes leaks through, but it largely is unknown. So over time, Freud's idea of that unconscious being, what he called the id, the cesspool of unacceptable desires, etc., which is accurate for most people, probably. However, there's much more to the unconscious than what is unacceptable. The psychologists over the last 100 years, and especially more recently, have explored the unconscious and discovered that there is a lot of very positive, valuable material processes in our unconscious. The dreams being an example of the expression of that. Our imagination comes from the unconscious. You know, when somebody says, what will you be doing 5 years from now? Or what do you want to be when you grow up? Children, of course, have wonderful access to their imagination, and they are accessing directly the unconscious mind. So they'll come up with an answer. I want to be a fireman or a nurse or a mother. And that is a direct expression of the deep unconscious.
So I have so many questions. So
me too.
So let's say, like, what if somebody were to ask you, like, okay, why is this information in the subconscious valuable? Can't I just get, like, let's say I have an issue in my life that I'm trying to work through. Maybe it's a relationship issue, a relational issue. Isn't it enough for me to just find a book and just, like, consciously understand the issue? Why would the subconscious be important in this healing process?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and one that the field of psychology struggles with in a very universal way. My answer to that is asking an individual to go back to the most recent New Year's resolution that you may have made. Not everybody does that, but most of us can relate at least to the mm-hmm. idea of periodically making an intention to change behavior. I'm going to eat differently. I'm going to exercise. I'm going to stop smoking, whatever it might be. Or I'm going to be more loving with my spouse. Most
That's all
people,
you mean, right? Success. Check the box right there.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the most important one for most people. Most people would have to acknowledge, I think, that the success rate of achieving those New Year's resolutions is pretty abysmally low. Why is that? Well, we have motivations to smoke or eat the way we eat or act toward our spouse in the way we do that are unknown to us. Oftentimes people will say, I don't know what got into me. You know, after a fight with your spouse or after eating a carton of ice cream. I don't know what got into me. Well, of course, nothing got into that person other than an unconscious motivation. And so the idea of bringing to conscious awareness our deeper motivations is what will allow more successful behavior change. We know that from a great deal of experience. There's a lot of research documenting that a behavior change is much more likely to occur and is much more likely to remain constant over a period of time, in other words, to be permanent, when the individual has been able to understand the multiple levels of motivation for the behavior. You know, when people go to addiction treatment, which is the most obvious example of an individual attempting to make behavior change, we know from experience that an addiction treatment program that is entirely cognitive, that is what you were saying, why wouldn't I just read some books or talk to somebody and find out what I can about why I'm doing this and then stop. Tends to be very unsuccessful. The addiction treatment programs that are much more likely to succeed and to prevent relapse are those that assist an individual to dig deeper, really much deeper, into the underlying motives for the behavior, which oftentimes go back to lifetime patterns developed usually in childhood.
So going back to the example of the New Year's resolution about, I want to be more loving toward my spouse.
Yeah.
That seems like a great idea. People can learn love languages. They can get the books. They can understand a specific behavior that they should engage in to show their spouse more love. And then they may go back to that space that you referenced where they're like, I don't know why I did that. I don't know what came over me.
Yeah.
Can you think of an example? Because I think especially right now, as we're recording this, people are in quarantine and a lot of people are around their spouse all the time. And they're probably having these questions of why, what do I need to do? Why is this so hard? So I'm wondering if you can think of, I know you can, will you give us an example of something that you see where love is difficult and people consciously can't figure out what the problem is, but when they start unpacking the subconscious programming, what might be in there that would lead to actual behavior change that they wouldn't necessarily see at a surface level?
Sure. I'll take the risk of using an example that fits a cultural stereotype. Always dangerous. Yeah. However, it may apply to a lot of people, or at least be recognizable to many people. The stereotype of a man and woman in a relationship, the woman wanting more conversation, discussion with her husband, and through that, more intimacy, and the husband sitting at the table or on the couch, reading the newspaper. Her experience is, in my stereotypical example here, is that he is ignoring her, and that's irritating. It is disrespectful. She experiences it as disrespectful and as a signal that he's not interested in more relationship with her. His experience is likely that he is avoiding what he does not feel competent to engage in, namely intimacy in relationship. So what might that go back to? Well, let's take this stereotypical mythical couple that I'm referring to, and go back in time. We do this through age regression in hypnotherapy. And we might discover that the man in this couple, as a child, had a very intrusive mother that was constantly in his business, let's say. And he rebelled against that. It was an intrusion that he resented as a child and growing up. Well, it's not surprising that this man would select for a partner someone who had some of the same behavioral characteristics. We tend to seek what we're familiar with. So he's sitting on the couch with his wife, reading the newspaper, and in his unconscious experience, it's not his wife sitting there attempting to have a conversation with him, it's his mother. And he's reacting in the same way he did with his mother. The woman in this mythical example is wanting intimacy, but she's attempting to create it in the only way she knows how. And let's say, perhaps, if we go back in age regression to her childhood, we discover that there was a constant effort on her part to create a satisfying relationship with her father, who was a workaholic and very seldom available to her as a girl, as a young child. And her way of attempting to get that need met as a small child was to become more and more insistent with her father about what she wanted, namely intimate, loving contact. Her father, in this mythical example, was unable to provide that. He was preoccupied with his work. And so her lifetime pattern that developed in relationship with a man was that she had to, her unconscious belief and behavior was that she had to be more and more intrusively demanding to get that need for a relationship met. And so here they are, and they're sitting on the couch. He's reading the paper, and it's not her husband that she's dealing with unconsciously. It's her father.
So why might it not work for these people to look at their family of origin and say, I am going to do everything in my power to not marry my father or my mother? I do not want to repeat the same relationship with my parents had. Or maybe they get divorced because they're so fed up with each other. Why might they continue to choose the same relationships again?
Yeah. That is a wonderful question. And we all know people, I imagine that we all know people who divorce from a relationship that's not satisfying or unhealthy and remarry someone that is very similar to their first spouse. And the question why, I would answer with, they have not yet uncovered the unconscious motivation that they have that they're attempting to fill in a childlike way with the behaviors that they learned as a child, which didn't work then and still don't. Fortunately, we do learn, most of us, from our experience, and many times an individual, after a relationship has been completed, I'll say, in other words, let's say through a divorce, goes on to find someone different and create a much healthier relationship. So we're not doomed to repeat our mistakes, but bringing to conscious awareness the reasons for our choices allows us to make much more conscious, intentional choice the next time.
I love that. And I think it's so important because I see so many people focusing on things that don't necessarily promote growth. And I think it takes deep work a lot of the time to understand the truth, what's buried in the subconscious mind.
Yeah, focusing on finances or appearances or qualities that maybe are ones that we learned as a child are vitally important. But if we allow ourselves to grow into a whole complete human being, sometimes we'll discover that those traits that we valued so much are actually less important than others.
That's such a big thing. And sometimes we waste a lot. Well, we don't waste time, but we look back and realize that we were maybe focusing on things that didn't make us peaceful or happy, but we thought they were the important things. And I think it's been tragic in my own life when I recognize that, but it's okay.
Well, I think that's a really important point, Jasmine, that it is tragic in some ways, but it's important to recognize that those times and lessons were not wasted. Yeah. It would be unfortunate, and it is unfortunate, for any of us to beat ourselves up about having made choices that perhaps didn't turn out as well as we would wish they had. And yet recognizing that in some way that experience was instrumental in allowing us to grow, learn, heal, and develop into a better person.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a perfect segue. So are you open to sharing a little bit about some of your life lessons and your stories that brought you to this work? So you said earlier that there's a lot of different opinions about this. So what was it that brought you to this work? How did you arrive here?
Well, in some ways that my response to that question would take me back further than my childhood, back further than the womb, back further than my conception in this lifetime 70-some years ago. I have the sense that I certainly have, not only lifetime patterns, but karmic patterns. And for me, the interest in understanding the depths and the heights of what is not commonly available in everyday consciousness has been a foreground interest of mine as long as far back as I can remember. I actually had an experience as a youngster. I'm going to say somewhere around 10 years old. I was riding my bike one day down a street near my home, and I fell, and there was on the pavement, and I really scraped my arm quite a bit. I mean, there it was an open wound. My parents took me to our family doctor, whose office was actually just a few blocks away. And now this is in the 1950s. He hypnotized me as an anesthetic while he treated the wound. And I remember so clearly him demonstrating to me ways in which I was in this mystical state of hypnosis, which I had never heard of before that moment in the doctor's exam room. And I was totally fascinated. It was very effective for the purpose he was using it for. And it was it was a very effective in opening my eyes to possibilities I'd never dreamed of in terms of the power of the human mind and the creative potential of the unconscious mind. And I, from that point on, I was really, well, I might say preoccupied. I sought out every opportunity to explore that realm, including some years later in the 1960s, many forms of drug use, psychedelic drugs. I have worked with shamanic people in the indigenous cultures on several continents, and I recognize that that is also another means of access to this deep unconscious that is far and away bigger, more powerful, and more represents more potential than our conscious mind can even conceive of. So I've it's been a lifetime of exploration for me, and I continue to be fascinated with the various ways we are discovering of exploring. Personally, I find the shamanic and hypnotic and meditation and breathwork modalities for that exploration much more satisfying than the substance use. But there's a place, I'm sure, for that for some individuals who can avoid the pitfall of addiction.
I just want to jump in here really quick and say that it's, if anybody were to see David at the grocery store, you would never imagine the words that are coming out of his mouth would match the person that you see. He's probably wearing some sort of flannel shirt and he has a big white beard. And you just wouldn't think that he would hold all of this information about shamanic. So people aren't looking at you. I just want to put out an image of the person that they're hearing. And you never know what somebody's personal experience, somebody's lifetime experiences by looking at them. I just think it's really, I think it just says something about the world and life and humans and how amazing humans are. Thank you.
Well, I agree. And I would extend that actually even further, as I was saying before about the karmic influences in our lives. Who would believe that an individual carries within them a martial artist or a prince, king, or a seductress that is part of their unconscious being, bleeding through occasionally from this long history that we have, I believe, that we have as human beings, going back through lifetimes.
I think what you're talking about, everything you talk about is important, but I think in my experience and even in my own life, I'm so grateful that I came to this work because I have a much better understanding of who I actually am. And I think a lot of us walk around this world never actually getting to know ourselves. And I want to hear more of your story. And so this is kind of a little segue. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about shock and dissociation.
Yes. Really important topics. One of the things that we know about human beings, all of us probably know this intuitively from our experience, and we'd certainly documented through research, that human beings have a way of not being present fully for experiences that are unpleasant, unexpected. An example would be, for many people, would be if you've had the experience of being in a car wreck. Almost anybody I've ever spoken to that has had that experience has a quite similar description of what it was like. The experience, for one, slowed down. It was almost like being able to watch the oncoming car or whatever the details of the accident were in slow motion. And oftentimes, initially, there may be some degree of panic, and then another state sets in. Oftentimes, a state of quiet and almost non-emotional. And sometimes after, you could walk up to somebody immediately following a car accident or any kind of accident, and observe this state of quiet. What that actually is the nervous system of the individual creating a defense against the panic that would be natural and that may have been the most immediate response. So we call that parasympathetic shock. Shock is, most people use that term for the state that we might go into, with an unexpected experience, especially if it's unpleasant or threatening in some way. I was shocked when, my spouse told me she wanted a divorce. The shock state is very natural. It is totally physiological. It's not unique to human beings. All animals have that response. And it's healthy that we do. It's a survival mechanism. The problem with it is that sometimes we might seek out that state as a defense in ways or at times that are really unhealthy for us. So drug use would be an example. It's not a coincidence. It's not random. The type of drugs that an individual chooses for their either recreation or self-medication. There are uppers and downers. And there are exploratory psychedelic drugs. It's not a coincidence that one person seeks out downers to deaden their experience, and someone else seeks out uppers to heighten their immediate experience. In both cases, that choice can be certainly healthy. An individual after a surgery who has a lot of pain clearly is doing themselves a favor by using the narcotic medications that the doctor has prescribed. That's a downer. Many of us, the first thing in the morning, have a cup of coffee. And if we're honest with ourselves, we're at least in part, we're doing that as a way to perk ourselves up. It's an upper. And those are healthy, potentially healthy uses, but it can become habitual. It can become extreme, and it can become addictive. Those means by which we attempt to manipulate the normal physiological response of the body. Dissociation is the process by which we check out from our immediate experience. And I think we've all had the experience of being in a conversation or talking with someone, or more likely someone talking to us that we're not much interested in. And at some point, coming back to conscious awareness and realizing we've missed whatever they said in the time period that we were gone. And sometimes that could be a matter of seconds, or certainly sometimes longer. Where do we go when we disappear like that, when we're not fully present for our immediate experience? Well, there are a lot of places we can go, all of which we call dissociation. It might be to daydream. It might be to worry. It might be to associations of memories. Could be to anticipation of something that is coming up. It could be to internal experiences, being preoccupied with one's digestive system or a pain in your knee. We can go lots of places when we dissociate. It always serves the purpose, however, of avoiding something that we do not want to be present for. And that's the key to understanding the importance of being able to make a conscious choice. Do I want to be present for this experience or not? Probably the pain that's in my body following a surgery. No, I really don't want to be present for that. The pain that is in my body following fight with my spouse. Am I really well served to avoid that, or am I better served to stay present to it, even though it's painful, to learn what I can in order to make more conscious choice next time?
So I encounter a lot of people who I think it's hard to identify an event that causes them to choose to leave. It feels like many people, this feels like a bold statement, but it feels like a lot of people are just generally not here. They're constantly distracting themselves. And maybe they're not conscious of what they're running away from. Maybe they're not choosing to run away, but they're not present. What is happening there? Like somebody who is a workaholic, somebody who doesn't necessarily seek a substance, but they have an endless to-do list. They're busy, 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 running around, maybe playing video games, acting out in some sort of behavioral addiction. What could be happening there?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. And I think oftentimes people are surprised to discover the answer. One of the things we do in therapy and then hypnotherapy is to, when we're working with an individual with a compulsive or addictive behavior pattern, is to ask that person to go back to the most recent time that they indulged that unhealthy habit, and then to go to what was happening immediately prior to indulging in their addiction or compulsion. And it's quite surprising to most people. For example, going back to last night when I was grazing through the kitchen looking for something to eat, and some of us have have a habitual overeating behavior pattern, and can perhaps relate to that experience of looking for, and really a habit, we have learned how to create stashes of the favorite substances that will meet the need. And so we don't need to graze. We go directly to where the stash is. In any event, going back to that moment of indulging, and then now, go back to what was happening for me just before that behavior Well, oftentimes it might be sadness, a feeling of emptiness, something missing in my life, perhaps an interaction with a child or a spouse or someone else important in your life that just wasn't satisfying. There was something about the interaction that felt there was something missing. So the emotional experience might be sadness, even more extreme might be described as despair. Well, if you were to talk to the individual in a therapy setting about what, when you were indulging your overeating behavior last night and you ate that half a carton of ice cream, but what was going on? And the answer would probably be nothing. I was not even present. I just dissociated and engaged in the behavior like I was on autopilot. But if you said to the individual, well, to your conscious mind, do you think it's possible you were feeling lonely or sad or, something in a relationship was unsatisfying? They might be able to recognize that as true, but likely not. But being able to access the unconscious allows an individual to make that shift in consciousness, to go back to the indulging behavior and then go back to what was happening just before that. And it's amazing to observe an individual whose mental abilities are that agile, and to discover what was it that was going on for me that triggered me to engage in that compulsive or addictive behavior. And oftentimes, as I say, it's something that the individual would not be consciously aware of.
I think this is so important, and I see it a lot in my work, and this is why I really believe in the somatic work, the hypnotherapy, the going back to get information outside of the conscious thought processes, because our adult conscious mind might look for something that would be obvious that happened. We may look for the origins of this behavior in something obviously traumatic. And sometimes it's often not something that's very obvious, but when it happened, when the behavior pattern started, we had a completely different brain. We had a different understanding of reality, our sense of security and safety. And so it may have been something that our adult brain would never even have recognized as something that would trigger this addictive, compulsive behavior pattern. But the way that we find information using the body, using hypnotherapy, finds data that we may never have found consciously.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to me, what you're describing, that in age regression work, oftentimes a person will go back to discover a truly traumatic experience. Obviously, many times it is something that we would all recognize as a terrible assault of some kind, but oftentimes it's something that we might not, our conscious mind might not at all recognize as traumatic. You know, somebody might go back to an experience as a third grader of being laughed at by other children because of you know, the clothes that I was wearing that day. And that may turn out to be a significant contributor to the development of a life pattern for me. And on the one hand, people might say, and that individual might say, well, that's not that's not traumatic. I wasn't, you know, being abused or neglected. But the unconscious mind carries the truth that, in fact, it was experienced as traumatic.
Yes. So powerful. Okay, so I want to go back to your story, talking about, which we could go off on a tangent about drugs and psychedelics and all that sort of thing. But I'm curious about what happened after these experiences. You talked a lot about not necessary, but life patterns, that life experiences that put you on the right path. So what was it that brought you to land where I met you at the space in Issaquah with somebody who we haven't mentioned yet, who's probably important to mention, Diane?
Yeah, she is always important to mention.
Yes, of course.
Diane was instrumental in my really course correction in my life. I met Diane when I was in my early 30s. And she had some substance abuse habits at that time, and so did I. And we saw the potential for going down in flames together, or ascending to a level of productivity and satisfaction in our lives that was going to only be possible if we changed those behavior patterns. So very soon after we met each other, we helped each other to course correct, and we have been clean and sober ever since.
So let's just be very clear that you're not advocating that she rescued you from the pit of despair. This was a conscious decision you both made together.
It was definitely a very mutual choice that we made. That's the only way it could have worked. None of us are powerful enough to change someone else's behavior or mind.
Thank you. It's so important.
But, yeah, very. And many of us have tried hard, devoted years of our lives to the attempt, unsuccessfully. No, we simply took a good look at where we were and where we could be, who the potential future selves were that we could create if we were making the healthiest possible choices. And that was very exciting. The potential for creating something beautiful and important out of our lives. That was a big motivation for both of us.
So then what happened?
Well, 40 years has gone by all too fast. And here I am.
And where are you?
Where am I? Actually, I'm looking out the window at my farm. We're getting ready. It's mid-March, and we're getting ready to...
It's April, but that's okay.
April. things have gotten timeless recently. Yeah. I think some of the other people that are experiencing this social distancing probably feel the same way. Mm-hmm. We're getting ready to plant our crop for the year. You know, there was the story of Ulysses or Odysseus, the Odyssey. Some people might be familiar with. He was a hero. He was like a Hercules, you know, the Superman, thousands of years ago, at least so the myth goes. And he had many, many adventures with Helen of Troy and all kinds of wars and lovers and et cetera. And at one point, he went home and decided he wanted to retire from that life of adventure. And he became a farmer and lived a very quiet life, tilling the field and planting and harvesting a crop. And that's what I'm doing.
So what did you do before this? What did you and Diane create together?
Well, the Wellness Institute is a network of people, many thousands of people worldwide, that have learned and are using the heart-centered hypnotherapy model of age regression therapy. And it's a healthy, vibrant community of healing people in throughout this the country, also in several countries in Africa, in the Middle East. And we have an active group of students in Turkey, Istanbul, right now. And they are excited to be bringing these same techniques that we've been using in America to their work with clients. They're all psychologists and therapists. Their clients in Turkey, in South America, Asia. It's been one of the fulfilling things for me to observe over these years is how universal the experience of exploring and discovering the unconscious mind is. So many different cultures, and the techniques for exploring and the unconscious are equally adaptable for people in all these different cultures. It's affirming to me that the human condition is so apparently different culturally, and yet in an essential way, human beings are one and the same.
Yes. Do you have any idea how many people have graduated from your initial training, the 6-day?
Oh, many thousands.
Yeah. So we're almost out of time here. So one final question: with all of your wisdom, the name of my podcast is the Live Your Life Podcast. What do you think it means to live a good life?
Well, there's a question you could spend a lifetime exploring.
Mm-hmm.
I would say for me, it is related to internal and external validation. When I am living my best possible life, I am being true to my inner nature, my most essential self. And at the same time, I am in harmony with my environment and with, which includes all the people that I come in contact with. We are, and at this time with the coronavirus, I think we're becoming more and more aware as a culture, society, of just how interrelated we are. It's not enough for me to have protection from being infected. The grocery store clerk that I occasionally encounter, or the UPS driver, you know, they also, their protection is equally important to me as my own. We are all in the same boat. And so for me, the good life, the best possible life, is one in which I'm true to myself and in harmony with all that is in my external life, the people, but also the land, the trees. You know, they provide us oxygen to breathe. The water that is either clean and pristine, or sometimes in some places carries disease. We just had Earth Day yesterday, and it's a reminder, I think, that we are interdependent with each other as human beings, with all of the animals and the plant kingdom, that we share this beautiful planet with.
I love it. So if people wanted to find your books or learn more about what you have learned, where might they find you?
Probably the easiest would be going to the website, the wellnessinstitute.org.
Perfect.
And there's a lot of information there about our 40 years of practices. And Diane and I have written a number of books that are available there. And also training for individuals who are interested in bringing this, being a facilitator of this type of healing work for others. All of that would be available at the on that website, wellnessinstitute.org.
Perfect. Well, David, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. We could have talked for hours. I have so many questions, but we will sit with an hour today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jasmine. I really appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion. And all the best to your listeners.
Thank you for listening to the Live Your Life podcast with me, Jasmine Savary, where I have inspiring conversations that invite you to fully live your life. I am a life coach and a licensed mental health counselor, but this podcast is not a replacement for counseling or healthcare services. If you find yourself in crisis, please call 911 or the National Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255.